That's what I always think. And I post about half of the conversations that I do. You know, some of them aren't appropriate for YouTube, and I got pointed to you by Stefan Fox over one of the Uber Boyos there, and and so then you and I have exchanged some emails back and forth. But why don't you introduce yourself?
Okay, hi, I'm Neil Whitman. I am a pastor here at Sovereign Grace Baptist Church in New Brunswick. I work right beside the Army base where I recently retired after 20 years as an infantry officer. I've served in Canada in the north, and I have been to Haiti and to Afghanistan and to Kuwait and to Israel in service capacity. And I have, I guess, a bit of a different experience than a lot of pastors out there, and probably than a lot of people who are engaged in this conversation. So I thought it'd be great to touch base, and you know, certainly appreciating what it is that you're putting out there. And so, yeah, that's me, I guess.
Have you had much of a chance to watch much of it? I mean, I put out a lot of video, so.
Well, you do. Yeah, that's for sure. You know, the funny thing is, Paul, so I mentioned to you, I think, in the email that I had sent, that the reason I got in touch with Uber Boyo in the first place, with Steph there in Ireland, is because one of the young fellows that I meet with quite regularly, usually twice a week, and sit down and talk through, really it's a young guy that's looking for meaning. He's looking for God, and as I kind of indicated, he's not always sure that's what he's looking for, but that's what he's looking for. And he ran across Steph, and he listened to pretty much everything that he produced, and he got me to listen to some of that. So I sat down and I worked through Steph and Jimmy's Aeon videos and got in touch with what Carl Jung had to say in that through their interpretation with him. And then I got in touch with Steph, had a conversation or two. And then he said, hey, there's this guy, Paul. And Paul's a guy that you really need to get in touch with because he's in this conversation like you are. And I think that you have a shared interest that you ought to communicate about. So that's really what led to me contacting you. Now, it is an aspect that has interested me for a long time. I think I may have mentioned to you, at least in passing in the email, that the folks I call Petersonians basically are every officer I've met under the age of 30 for the last 5 years.
Wow.
Of course, being a Canadian professor, and that being a subject of much concern in the midst of our own service as well, the subject for which he was first called out, and then his meteoric kind of rise to prominence in the conversation, he has been kind of a rallying point, I think, for a lot of young men who are looking for something beyond just the bland political correctness that seems to be the driving force that is pushing down from our government, right? And so he's become enormously popular, and I've definitely familiarized myself very much with Peterson. Kind of a shame to say I haven't read much of his work. I've just listened to a lot of his lectures and sat through that to familiarize myself with his perspective and what he's bringing to the table, which, you know, I know I'm waxing long, but...
No, keep going. You're doing fine.
I've probably listened to about 6 hours of you since I was introduced to you there before Christmas. So,
okay.
Particularly appreciate the Paul and Freddie show.
Oh, people don't value the Freddie and Paul. It's Freddie and Paul.
Freddie and Paul.
It was one episode was Paul and Freddie, but I insisted we put it back because
good.
Yeah, and I'm sure you as a pastor have some I mean, I love how you come to this conversation, because for a lot of people who watch my channel, you know, there's a lot of mystery out there. What do pastors do?
Yes.
And you described it very well. You meet with this guy and you talk. And well, what do you talk about? Well, you talk about whatever it is you need to talk about.
That's right. Yeah, it's actually funny because tonight I was teaching on 1 Timothy 3, which is always an uncomfortable passage for a pastor, isn't it? But one of the points that I was highlighting is that there's really no description of what a pastor does. Yeah. There's a description of what a pastor's supposed to accomplish, and there's a description of a pastor's character, but there's never any explanation of how you do it.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because you do it in whatever way you have to get it done.
That's right. That's true. Well, I want you to say more about that statement about, you know, a Petersonian is every officer that you've met under 30 for the last 5 years. Flesh that out a little bit more. I mean, for those of us, I mean, Peterson obviously really struck a nerve in the United States, mm-hmm. but, you know, he's Canadian, you know, thoroughly so. I have a brother-in-law who grew up in Manitoba. So, and when I started listening to Jordan Peterson, I thought, oh boy, kind of sounds like my brother-in-law Tom in some ways, that northern Canadian, especially Western spirit. So what do you mean by every officer that you've met under 30 for the last 5 years? What have you seen?
Well, I mean, that is a story that probably takes a little more than just a casual telling, but let me try and be as succinct as I can when I answer that. So context matters.
Yes.
When you're talking about something like this. So the context is Afghanistan. The context can't really be understood without understanding that Canada participated in that conflict in a very direct way. Mm-hmm. So starting in 2006, the Canadian forces moved to Kandahar from where we had since 2001 been just doing security kind of on an American base up in Kabul, which, you know, we did lose men up there, but it was still a relatively benign portion of that conflict. And when we did go down to the Kandahar area and start operating there with the American forces, it was deeply kinetic. There was a lot of fighting, and a lot of Canadian men and women lost their lives doing that. You know, the tour that I was on in 2007, it was interesting. One of my sergeants made the point afterwards that, do you know that if we just dealt out a deck cards on the plane ride in, jokers would have been dead. If you want to do the numbers on how that went down. And that seems not so bad, I suppose, in terms of conflict. And you'd be right. Like, it's not Dieppe, that's for sure. It's not the D-Day landings. But in a tight-knit group like that, it's very significant. And that doesn't at all speak to how many guys were deeply injured or badly wounded mentally and spiritually over there. So we came out of that environment where we were told to be warriors. And everywhere you went in the army, there were posters about the warrior ideals and the warrior ethos and the ideal of being able to rise above yourself. And all of this was like the classical manly characteristics, if you will, right, that was being just praised and celebrated amongst men and women, that, you know, you go and you overcome and you strive for the greatest performance that you can, and you sacrifice for others and you be a defender and all of this stuff, you know, was just the championed idea of the armed forces during that period of time. And it was very important, and we had a very strong morale within the armed forces. But then, you know, I guess it would be the turning point happened around 2012, and we left that field of combat and went on to a training mission. And at about the same time, You know, there was a big shift in the focus, and it wasn't dramatic at first. The conservative government was still in power, and they still spoke a lot about the positivity of, you know, soldiering and all that stuff. And the messaging didn't change, but certainly the focus changed. And then we did get a new government, and that new government put out a new white paper, which is defense policy. And they really stripped everything away. And the whole focus of the military became to be the kinder, gentler, more politically correct army. And that had a very profound and damaging effect on the psyche of so many of these soldiers, because you've been told for so long, it's a good thing that you're a warrior. It's a good thing to be violent and aggressive, you know. And, you know, I will actually acknowledge that we tolerated a lot of really, I won't disagree, inappropriate sort of sexualized dialogue and behavior, which should never have really been the case, but it was there and it was part of that. And it's sort of a traditionally soldierly thing to just kind of ignore and push off. And I'm not saying that's right, but the focus changed, and there was a thing called the Deschamps Report that came out. And the Deschamps Report basically spoke to gross sexual impropriety within the Canadian Armed Forces. And at that time, the CDS got fired for basically saying you're overreacting. And in fairness, you know, he was to a degree correct, because what had happened was someone who was an academic had gone in and basically taken a survey, but they made extrapolations on data based on the reports that they got, which were a very small percentage of the total population. But then, you know, without really acknowledging reporting bias, they extrapolated that data to the whole armed forces. And I would say some of that is questionable to be scientifically extended, but certainly the parts that spoke about the experience of sexualized joking and language, I never contend that's not a huge part of it. And that there were very real tolerance of sexual abuse that happened there, and that's not cool. But the response at that time was then to say, okay, we've got a volatile army that's not playing the game. And so they instituted Op Honor, and this was a new operation that was targeted towards removing any sexualized behavior in the armed forces, and to coming down extremely hard on anything that might even carry the flavor of discrimination against gender or transgender or sexual behavior of any kind. And then there was a huge input to try and create more recognition and celebration of these other lifestyles. And this became literally the stated main effort of the Army, was to change our sexual behavior to a modern, inclusive attitude. And what that did was it took warriors who had sacrificed a great deal in what they thought was service of the country, and it told them, you're monsters and your aggressive behavior is monstrous, and we don't actually care about aggression and violence like we've been asking you to do these things. Those are bad things. You shouldn't have done them in the first place, you know. And what's really important is that you just don't ever think dirty thoughts.
Wow.
Right. And so you can imagine then that the reaction to that has been to covertly look to something that doesn't destroy morale so badly. And Peterson is that polite and reasonable guy who can say, you know, no one's saying that males taking license and treating women disrespectfully is a good thing. But at the same time, making men enemies is a bad thing. And, you know, particularly in the more male-dominated combat arms, I think there's a perception of persecution, and it's not without grounding amongst the young men that they're looking for something that actually gives them affirmation, and they're not finding it in the army. So they have found it in Peterson and in quiet conversation about, you know, hey, we're not really terrible people, right? And that's really where I think that comes from. So I'm sorry for taking so long.
No.
That, but it does seem to.
And, you know, it's, I mean, these are obviously one of the things you learn making videos is that, yeah, context matters, and people know me somewhat because they hear me talk maybe an hour or so a day, and people don't know you at all because you're just a pastor on the other end of things. Now you weren't a chaplain in the armed services, correct?
No, I was an infantry officer. I was a rifleman, yeah. A leader of riflemen. Yes.
And I think it's, you know, it's always funny. It's always interesting to me, having watched the reputation of Christianity in the past waves of cultural change, where Christians on one hand get mocked for professing standards of sexuality which are unreasonably high.
Yes.
Because, of course, I mean, no one who reads Jesus or the New Testament would get a sense of, well, why Christians have, you know, traditional Christian sexual morality is what it is, even though, you know, Christians quite often fail to live up to it. I mean, that's also true, which we know, but the knock has been that Christians take sexuality too seriously. All of a sudden then to see in an interesting way voices that have been cheering a much more libertine, liberated sexuality swoop in and, you know, take the other position in a, you know, it's in some ways men just can't win this.
I think that's probably fair. Yeah.
Because, you know, the church has traditionally told men, you know, you need to respect women, and respecting women means self-control. It means that Christian men do and don't say certain things. Christian men do and don't do different certain things. In fact, Christian men do and don't think different things. But this is contextualized in a realm of Christian devotion. And to have the government sort of come around the other way with a, you know, so these are the ways you're supposed to be sexual, and these are the ways you're not. I mean, that's always turn it on, turn it off. And, well, for most of us, you don't really just turn on and turn off sexuality. You walk around it with it all the time, and you modulate perhaps your expression, your words, your behavior, some of these things, but it's always something you're dealing with. And so, again, to have Christians for a long time being told you're way too prudish, and now come around the other side and say, oh, you're way too sexual. It's like, wait a minute. Not quite sure what you'd like us to do.
Gender is the offense, right?
Yeah. So you wrote this about me, but I was quite struck by your story. You're in the ministry now, and a lot of people are very curious about how that goes. Yeah. Why don't you say something to that story too?
Well, the joke I like to tell is that my previous job was about sending people to God, and this one is too, so it seemed like a good fit.
with quite different means, however.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting, and if you'll bear with me, I'll wax a little long to try and explain that. So I gave my life to Christ. I found my meaning in Christ when I was around coming on 17. And it was about 6 months later, I joined the Army, and I went off and did my basic training and all that stuff, and spent 4 years at military college, and I don't really need to get into all that, but, you know, I was like any young man, not without my sins and errors, but God was still the center, and he stayed the center, and that was, you know, an important part of my growth as a young man. And I went to battalion for the first time in 2003. And it was 6 months later, I went down to Haiti. And something about that is that although I was a believer, I think that it's, as is common to a young man, it was very much my faith, you know, and I was exercising it, and it was a tool that I was using, and I, you know, like every young man, was going to be great, right? So I'm 21, I show up at battalion, I'm now in charge of a platoon of 30 men, and within 6 months now I'm deployed to Haiti and doing peacekeeping operations there when the Aristide government had fallen in 2004, and you know, I was there and I was going to do good things and I was going to be a force for good in the world. And what I quickly found was that nothing worked, right?
That's Haiti.
That's Haiti, as you know, right?
Yes. So
I would say one really symbolic thing that happened would be when we were looking for a gentleman by the name of T-Will, who was the leader of the cannibal gang in Gunaheve, I would go out daily, usually twice a day on patrol. I would cut my platoon in half and we'd patrol different areas and we would just canvass people and talk. And then if we found any information, we would do things like coordinate searches. And you know, we did a lot of quite successful rounding up of gang members and weapons and things like that that were being used for violence. And it probably helps to say that we started in Port-au-Prince where we had been very successful. But then we moved up to Gonaïves, and after we left Port-au-Prince and the UN took over that area, a great number of the people we've been working with were executed in the streets because the gangs took over again. And then they made a point of showing that they were not defeated by doing a lot of like schoolhouse shootings and marketplace shootings. And all of that was peripheral awareness through our intelligence mechanisms of what had started to happen down there. And so I was at the police station to pick up a ride along from the local police forces who, as you'll not be surprised to hear, weren't paid, you know, and all of that that comes along with that in third world police agencies, which generally means they're gangs too. And I picked this young fella up and he says to me, I know where T. Will is. So, awesome, you know, young 22-year-old now, Neil Whitman is going to go and catch the head of the cannibal gang, right? Awesome, let's do this. And I set it up and got a plan in place. My boss approved it, and we got over there, did our little search, and there was no one there. There's nothing there. And the next day, he was executed. Shot back ahead.
The one who had told you, yeah. The informant, yeah.
And I was like, ooh, right. And then 4 days later, I was picking up my ride-along at the police station. A different young cop gets in and he says, I know where T. Will is. And I was like, all right. If you do this, they're going to kill you. And he said, I know. But I joined the police to help my country. And he was a Christian. He said, I love Jesus and this is right. And this is what I want to do. So we did a search.
That's right.
Found nothing. The next day he was killed. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, what am I doing? Yeah. There is a funny sort of conclusion to that story, which is that later, some time later, that individual drove right into one of our vehicle checkpoints. And when my sergeant stopped him and said, you know, do you got any guns? He's like, I'm T. Will. Who do you think you are? And Blair Williams, my sergeant, was like, excuse me? Who did you say you were? He said, T. Will. He's like, oh, cool. Well, I'm Big Willie. Bam, get out of the car. we got a hold of him. But I just, you know, I guess that's God's blessing to that young man. Maybe that he did that. But, you know, like, instead of doing good.
Uh-oh.
And nothing good is happening. And, you know, you get very cynical and dark-minded, and you deal with that every day. And, you know, it didn't feel good. As a missionary, you're there and you're doing something that is got at least the promise of some eternal worth, maybe. But I'm there to give peace and security to people who are just going to die anyway.
Yeah.
And I will tell you, the culminating thing that happened for me on that tour was I was doing a cordon and search on a house which turned out to be a voodoo shrine, which was associated with the gangs and whatnot. And as I was, I let my Acadian interpreter, Frankie, who spoke the local Creole quite well after that amount of time there, to grill the owner of the house for a bit. And while my guys were searching, I walked back and leaned against the wall on the other side of the road. And this little girl walked along, and street girl, and she climbed up on the wall right beside my shoulder. And I looked up at her and said, hello. And she looked down at me and she said, you know, in French, that, you know, bonjour, monsieur, est-ce que tu peux voir les étoiles? You know, hi, sir, can you see the stars?
Hmm.
And I said, yeah, I can see the stars. They're pretty, aren't they? And she said, yes, they're beautiful. And did you know that Jesus made them for you and he loves you very much? And I said, yeah, I know that. And and then she said to me, did you know that if you love him back, that you'll get to go and be with him when you die? That's where I'm going. And I thought, you know, what is it about this that brings hope where nothing else can?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that changed my mind about a lot of things that I had put so much of myself into trying to be the hero. And as I did that, you know, that always stuck with me. But then we went to Afghanistan, and, you know, I have no reservations about what we did there. Our means of doing it was, I think, legitimate. I think what was trying to be done was honestly with good intent. I think it was pretty naive to imagine that a fundamentalist, extremist Muslim population was going to turn American if they just got democracy. But I think the idea was nevertheless quite altruistic. You know, it might not be popular to say this. I think that your former president, George Bush, was actually reasonably decent in his intentions, even if he wasn't always wise in the way he executed them.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, we did that and we killed a bunch of people, man. We killed a bunch of people who wanted to risk that happening to them to try and undo what we were trying to do. And that didn't work. And you know, it's like, did that and went to the north to do sovereignty for 3 years, running around the Arctic doing all kinds of crazy cool stuff. And
what's that? What do you mean you went north to do sovereignty? What does that mean?
Oh, well, we have We have what are called the Canadian Rangers. They're First Nations, primarily reservists that live all across the Arctic territories, so east of Alaska. And so I worked with them for 3 years doing like regular training and high Arctic patrolling. Yeah, you know, that's where I shot that guy. Got the muskox at home. And whales and seals, sorry to your animal loving people, but the Inuit still live off an all animal diet, and so yeah. that's what we did. And it's basically about just preventing someone else, probably mostly you guys, from claiming that you own the Arctic. We say it's the Russians, but we really mean you guys.
Well, there might be oil under there.
That's right. Anyway, and after that, I went back and, I've commanded a rifle company and a support company. I went over to Kuwait, where I worked with General Dynamics Land Systems for about 3 months, trying to create international trade agreements on their purchase of our Lab 3, which is actually the same platform your army uses. They buy it from Canada, go figure, the Stryker, and a good vehicle, but which was an attempt to create unity and peace through commerce, you know.
Yeah.
And we all know how well that's working out. And then I spent a year in Jerusalem as a diplomat, working with the Palestinian Armed Forces and the Israeli Defense Force, you know, peripherally, to help them professionalize and meet the international standards. And we all know how that's working out.
Yeah.
So the long answer to your question is, I would like to bring the only hope that I know that does something, because I know that what that little girl had works.
Yeah.
And I know that nothing else does. And I see all around me my peers and colleagues falling victim to hopelessness and despair, to post-traumatic stress disorder, which destroys the soul. And I often feel like I'm just standing there with a jar full of water and people in the desert that are dying of thirst, and they don't want to drink it.
Yeah.
And so here I am, and here I stand with the only thing I can bring to the table.
Okay. So tell me about your church.
Yeah, it's not a big church. We're right outside the Army base. It's probably about half military, maybe a little more, and a little bit of the local folk and folks that have retired here and from the Army and such as well. And it's a Baptist church. We're just trying to live Christ in this community and be a light as best we can, you know.
Yeah.
Got about, I'd say, 80-ish regular attenders, and that's all I can really say to that question, I suppose.
Okay. Well, I've peppered you with questions, and anything you came to this that you wanted to cover?
Yeah, well, so here's what I would throw at you, I suppose. Some thoughts that I have in regards to the conversation that you're engaging in. And say that it's a conversation I'd like to engage in as well. I don't come at this arrogantly presuming like I have anything like the genius or wisdom of yourself or Vervaeke or Peugeot or anything like that. But I do think that I have some experiences which afford me a different perspective than is often given to this problem of the meaning crisis. And 2 points I just throw at you, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. My observation would be, particularly in regards to your observations of the, I believe you call it the progressive post-evangelicalism.
Yeah.
Is, I think, what I perceive to be one of the major problems that is leading to this bleed and this despair, really, that causes people to run from the church as a competent counselor would be, firstly, that the evangelical church has really failed at giving a prophylaxis to reality. So, as a guy who has experienced in a very raw and real way the brokenness of the world and the incredible depravity and capacity for evil in mankind, as I know you surely will have done also, I don't think the evangelical church has generally done a very good job of trying to prepare people for that reality. I don't think they have really tried earnestly to address the problem of evil, or if they have, perhaps the problem that you articulated, which I think is very astute, is that the God that they have been taught about is not the God of the Bible, and that's part of the problem, is that we've created our own God who isn't exactly Jehovah, and who doesn't have exactly that answer to evil that he does. And I think that's part of the problem. The second part of it that I think is very real is it lacks also a remedy when people have been hurt. So you have poor prophylaxis and then no remedy, because when somebody comes in and they have been hurt by the world and by evil, rather than try and deal with that in a way that is intimate and based on spiritual truth, the church runs to psychology and says, well, those guys are the experts, so go talk to him. And something that I would observe is that psychological treatment is possibly quite good and can be quite good for a lot of things, but it does nothing for moral injuries. Because it denies the reality of morality even as a thing beyond a figment of your imagination. So when what someone is dealing with is the fact that they themselves have sinned or participated in sin by not stopping sin, psychology has nothing to do with that. And I see this all the time in soldiers that, you know, I'll give you a really quick and interesting anecdote, and then you can comment on every nonsensical thing I just said.
Nonsense.
So when we were in Afghanistan, one of my sergeants, Sergeant Collette, got himself in a bit of trouble, actually, because one of our national broadcasting, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation reporters had come over, and he'd asked Collette why we were doing this, you know, like what motivated us. It was, I think, a pretty genuine and benign question. But Collette, being the introspective and serious guy that he was, he paused and he responded and said, words to the effect of, well, I think that some guys are here because they just always wanted to kill someone. And this is the only way to do that that's acceptable. And I think that some guys are here because they actually believe in what we're doing and they have an ideological reason, but there's not a lot. I would say in the main, we're here because we're getting $30,000 to show up and everyone's looking for a new truck. And you know what? That's not enough for killing people or losing friends. That was very insightful. This is a problem when we don't equip people with sound reasons for what they're doing, and then they do something and they don't have a good reason to have done it. And then that gnaws away at the inside of that person until, that's maybe an extreme example, but I believe it extends to so much of life, that when we don't go informed into the world and know why we're going to do the things that we're doing, that we risk hurting ourselves quite badly and hurting our consciences. So So that's my thoughts. What are your thoughts?
I think those are all good thoughts. I haven't talked about this partly because it's hard to formulate. You know, the most difficult things to talk about are the things that are so ubiquitous and assumed and present all around us. Those are the hardest things for us to see. You know, it's like the old fish story where, you know, one fish talks to the other, how's the water? And the other fish says, what's water? I have for many years been convinced that part of why, and I think you and I, well, I'll tell a little bit about my own story. I do a lot of talking, but I don't necessarily tell my own stories that much on my channel.
I think that's true.
Well, you know, but most of us don't necessarily think our stories are that interesting, but when asked, we talk. And, you know, well, first of all, you know, I grew up, my father was a pastor in a very poor neighborhood in Paterson, New Jersey. And he was called by the local Christian Reformed churches to see if he could, in 1960, transform what had been sort of a, you know, handout bread and sandwiches salvation station in an area of Paterson where poor black folks moved up from the South to get industry jobs in Paterson. And the Dutch immigrants were sort of doing well and moving up to better houses and suburbs and, you know, things in the post-war years. And black folks had moved up and had settled in these old neighborhoods, and the churches had sort of moved out. But there are always some soft-hearted, kind-hearted Christians who looked and said, you know, these poor people, they, you know, it's hard and it's a mess and they suffer. So we ought to try and do something. And so, you know, they try and do something with whatever lights they have, you know, which whatever they think might help. And sometimes that helps and sometimes it doesn't, because none of us know. And so they had this little mission station, and after a number of years of just throwing money at it, they thought, why don't we try and turn it into a church where it's not just a mission station, but it's a church. So they called my father, and in 1960, he and my mother, fresh out of college and seminary, went there. And my father, I don't think my father ever saw a black person, perhaps outside of a porter car, you know, because he was from Minnesota and Wisconsin and Iowa. And my grandfather had churches out on the prairie. And then my grandfather took a church to Owen Sound, Ontario, which later I met some folks from Owen Sound. They said, yeah, it's right under the elephant's tail. And so what did he know about black folks moving up from the South? And he went there, and he basically, because he understood Christianity from my grandfather and the gospel, figure out, well, love people as best you can in whatever weird circumstance you're at, and, you know, try to do church. And, you know, when you look back on it, you know, all kinds of mess, but, you know, you just learn, you know, if you want to love people, you just learn. And so that's the context that I grew up in. And then I, you know, I get an education, and I knew about ministry, and I knew about poverty, and I knew about all these things because when and where I grew up. And then, you know, my wife really wanted to go overseas because her parents had been missionaries in Nigeria. And so, you know, all kinds of things. We wind up in the Dominican Republic, and I've got my seminary education, and I've got, you know, books, and you know, working with Haitians, and Haitians who are illegal in the Dominican Republic for the most part. And they're picking coffee and they're cutting sugar cane. And when the political winds blow, you know, they can get rounded up and put on a truck and trucked over to Haiti and dumped off on the other side of the border. And, Yeah. You know, most of the pastors I'm supposed to teach are twice my age and more than twice my life experience, you know, mm-hmm. and most of the pastors, the average education they had was second grade Haitian. And, yeah. you know, I'm there to teach them. Well, yeah, I learned a lot. I learned a lot about how much I didn't know. And I learned a lot about how complicated the world is. And I learned a lot about all these good intentions that we, you know, tried to do to help people learn this or do this. And no, you don't change people or change a culture or change a way of life. But I remember I came back after a year and I'd have a seminary exam because my first year was my internship. And, you know, I had written a sermon in which I was a little bit too, in this person's mind, a little bit too talking about, you know, life after death. Mm. And I, you know, not enough realized eschatology in that sermon. I said, well, I'll tell you something. Most of the people I'm working with don't have a lot of realized eschatology in their life. Their life is hard and it's short and they suffer and they're often just trying to do whatever they can to get by. And in the midst of that, every now and then, you'll meet a crooked pastor who's just trying to, you know, use the church to make money or, you know, sleep with people or whatever. And then sometimes you also meet people that the faith that they have and the sacrifice that they bear for the sake of the gospel, you know, makes me feel like an idiot. And, you know, can make me feel guilty about who I am and what I've had and where I've gone. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that doesn't leave you. And so, and where was I going with this? Oh, yeah, this is why I take notes so I can remember. Here in North America, we live in this place that is so secure. I mean, I remember coming back from the Dominican Republic and just laughing at the fact that in North America, when you run a clock, you plug it into the wall because electricity is that, you know, reliable that you can run a clock on it. In the Dominican Republic, the water goes on and off, the lights go on and off, you know, and I'm living a life far more secure than any of these Haitians, but
that's,
we live this life.
The best part of the island too.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I've been to Haiti, and, you know, a lot of people told me, you know, going from the United States to the Dominican Republic, it's about that same difference going from the Dominican Republic to Haiti. And there are places in the world that are far worse than Haiti. You know, you look at places like Somalia, some places in Africa. And so you realize in North America that we're submitted to a barrage of that carries on a subtle message that says something like this: life is easy. If you're kind of moderately moral, you'll be rewarded. If you do the right thing, you'll be happy and successful, and all of your dreams will come true. Mm. Oh. And you know, for a lot of people, in a lot of ways, you can carve out a really nice life in North America compared to a lot of the rest of the world, especially compared to history. Wow, we have it good. We have it so good.
Yeah.
And then you read the Bible. And, you know, I listen to a lot of atheists that I think both you know, Tom Holland recently, and I can't think of his name right now. It'll come up. What's that?
Sam Harris.
Well, no, not Sam Harris. Tom Holland, and I can't think of his name. He's a French. But basically, the complaints about Christianity are all from Christianity, and this is what's so ironic about, you know, the number done on those soldiers by the change in the Canadian government. It's sort of a, you know, respecting women. Yeah, that's a Christian idea. You want to see a place where women aren't respected? Look at just about most of the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And that respect has to come from the inside out. And it has to come from a changed heart, because we as natural human beings and we as natural men very much want to use women for our own gratification. And that's what's natural. That's how we are. And what it takes to not do that, it takes a lot. And it takes a lot from the inside, and it takes training from the outside. And that's really tricky business. And so, you know, the God, and then I watch the rise of the problem of evil. And Tim Keller, in his book on suffering, which I think is his best book, noted that, you know, the current shape of the problem of evil really didn't get popular traction until modernity and the Enlightenment really got going. And I think that says a lot, because whereas when I talk to Haitians, they certainly suffered and they certainly asked, where is God and why does this happen to me and all of that? And it, you know, it sounds like Job and it sounds like the Psalms. That version of the problem of evil is ubiquitous. But this Western version of the problem of evil that basically sets up for us an expectation that, you know, God's just here to give me everything I want. And when I don't get everything I want, and that those expectations keep getting higher, well, then I'm going to be angry at God and judge him. And I think, what sense does that make? You know, you're almost better off giving up all the language about it and going and being an atheist, because, you know, go ahead, judge God if you want to. God seems quite capable of hearing our judgment and not flinching. So the God that we've been taught about is not the God of the Bible. I think the God that we've been taught about has seeped into our pores by a million subtle messages from a consumer culture that suggests we live in a world that we don't live in. And those times and places, whether they're in war zones, which are overseas, or war zones that are in the middle of an affluent neighborhood with a divorce underway, those are revelatory. And they're revelatory, and I think you're exactly right. They're revelatory about who we are.
Yeah.
And once, I like how you put it, that there's a moral hurt. There's a moral injury. And, you know, when Peterson noted, he said, you know, people don't get PTSD by seeing stuff. People get it because they've done something. And they seem, and for the little I know about it, what I would imagine is they had a vision of themselves, which has been brought about by this culture, that says, you are a good person, and you will make good decisions, and really, you're quite nice to people. That's how you are. Yeah, that's how you are until something happens. And your niceness is no longer working to get you what you want. And then another side of us comes out, and we're not prepared to see that person. But I think for most of human history, we've not lived within that warm bath of a consumer marketing culture that had subtly suggested to us that we're really moral, you know, we're really moral heroes. No, we're not. We just have really easy lives. And we live in a culture that has been dramatically good in many ways, affluent and successful, that affords some, you know, a pretty low grade morality to just get by. But if you're in a place in the world where you afford none of that, things start to look differently. Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of the reason, you know, I stay a Christian, and, you know, you say this, you can say this stuff and people don't believe you because they see me on YouTube and he's a pastor, and, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I say, I'm a Calvinist because I know what a monster I am on the inside. And people are like, oh, you're not a monster. You're nice. Yeah. Yeah. But a lot of my niceness is, you know, a lot of my niceness is pretty self-serving. And you know, the accuser's comment to God when God says, consider my servant Job, you know, I think you'd say, consider my servant Paul. And God would say, yeah, he does a lot of nice things to improve his status among people. And he's good often because it pays. And you pull all that stuff off. You know, I love it when Jesus says, you know, even though you're evil, you give good gifts to your children. We always jump over that. Jesus just said good parents are evil. Yeah, he did. And yeah, he's right. And, you know, I can't exclude myself from that community of the evil. I just live in a place that affords me.
Be good parents.
What's that?
I should, or at least that evil people can be good parents.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, that's my take on this.
If I could just jump in for a second there, Paul. It's interesting. So when I went through training as an infantry guy, and we still do this to varying degrees of severity, one of the things that they do is that they subject you to sleep deprivation. So when we went through, they took us for like a 6-day combat withdrawal, which means you've got your rucksack on, which is loaded with, you know, 60 to 100 pounds of gear. And then you walk a kilometer, dig a hole in the ground for 5 hours and get attacked, and then withdraw off the position, walk a kilometer, dig a hole in the ground for 5 hours, get attacked, and repeat for like 6 days with no rest periods. And that's not to say you didn't fall asleep, but there was no actual rest. And when you did fall asleep, it was not a pleasant experience when you get caught. So what that does is it strips everything away. All of the polite stuff that you tell yourself you are, it goes away when you are deprived of everything. And only the very core things that you have are still functioning. You know, if you looked at David Grossman, who wrote the book On Killing and the book On Combat, really good psychological analysis of people and the reactions to these things. Talks quite a bit about that. And the sleep studies would say that, you know, after not sleeping for, I think it's 4 days, you're functionally mentally handicapped. Like, you've lost, like, you know, something like 60% of your IQ points. And that just reveals you. And I think it's unfortunate for those people that you describe who it's not until they end up in the divorce proceeding in their upper crust environment and life that everything gets ripped away and who they really are gets revealed to them. You know, they can cushion it for an awful long time in our affluent society. And it's those extreme moments. I think part of the reason they are so traumatic is that it takes and strips so much away that is built up over years that perhaps your Haitian friends as believers had stripped away much quicker.
That's right. They never had it built up on them. It was bad from the start. And most of humanity has lived that way.
Yeah. One thing that I thought was kind of interesting, just as an aside, but not entirely, because it speaks to our culture. And one of the things we are contending with in this conversation, if you look at Samson, the character of Judges, and you look at the commentary surrounding Samson, so no one ever said, oh, Samson was a great guy through and through, and he never did anything wrong. I mean, it's very obvious that Samson was a sinner. He slept with a prostitute. He slept with Delilah and gave his secret away, and bad things happened. But no one before the 18th century ever said anything bad about the way that he killed people. That is a very modern invention, that Samson was an evil, bad man who wasn't a good Christian because he killed Philistines.
That's interesting.
And why I say that is there's something we've done as a culture where we have gone and said, the warrior mentality, that's bad. And violence is bad. And, you know, anything that isn't tolerance is bad. And that gets really hard because the reality is that that can't work, right? You tell people that the only thing that works is tolerance, but it is impossible to function if you are not subjective in your evaluation of cultures and ideas. And yet you're actually causing people to sin against the values you've told them they must hold when they then have to do the thing that you've told them they can't do in order to just function as a person. It's tremendously broken.
Yeah. Yeah. These questions are so hard. They're so difficult. And one of the things that I got interested in Peterson, but when he talked about the fact that he said, you know, when you go through Auschwitz, you shouldn't imagine, oh, what horrible people did this. You should recognize, no, this is what we are capable of. And as a pastor, one of the things that I've seen again and again is that so often, you know, we're not really serious about the gospel. And this is until, like you said, all those things are stripped away. That's why there are so many people that become Christian in prison. That's why so many people become Christian in rehab. Mm-hmm. You know, this world, you know, there are so many questions we can't answer. Mm-hmm. And I myself am not a pacifist. But, you know, it's Christianity looks toward the day that all wars cease. And how do we work that out in the meantime, you know? Mm-hmm. And you have that in small ways too. You know, I'm a Calvinist preacher who preaches grace, and at also other times I, you know, hold people accountable, and you know, I have my ways of working that out. But these are all difficult things, and yeah. Each moment we live in is, you know, the current cultural moment. They keep moving and they keep changing, and we don't know how they go, and we each have to make up our minds about what we will do with the time that we've been given. So we do. So I really appreciate that that you take the time to meet with that young man and to talk with him, because, you know, as a pastor, Those are some of the most important things that we do. And you know that. I mean, standing in front of a group of people and giving them a message, yeah, that's important. And God works through that.
But I'll put it the other way. I appreciate that he meets with me.
Yeah. Well, and this is the strangest thing about this whole video thing for me. I was just commenting to someone who wrote me, said, you know, for years as a small church pastor, I go through quite a few weeks of not having someone sit down with me and have earnest questions about reality and get to talk on a heart-to-heart level. And then I start a YouTube channel and they come out of the woodwork. Mm. So I guess YouTube's not a bad thing.
Well, it is quite neutral. Can be used for good things and bad things.
Yeah.
Another thought, if you don't mind me throwing a quick one at you, that's probably not that quick. The meaning crisis. As I listen to a lot of the conversation that's going on in this regard, I wish for a different dialogue. Not a different dialogue, maybe, but put it this way. The meaning crisis is a very complicated thing, and you just talked about how complicated the world is, and it is. It is a very complicated thing. And you talk about, you know, not a pacifist, but we don't actually want to celebrate violence. And how is it that God, who wants to take the life of someone who murders, can also then say, but you need to now go and kill those people? And that both of these things can be true, and that's complicated. And that takes perhaps some real serious talking to work through and investigating things. But if we're talking about hope, we're talking about purpose, the meaning crisis, what is the reason to be, what is the reason to actually do anything and to strive for anything? It strikes me as a Gordian knot type problem, that the problem itself is enormously complex, and yet I think sometimes the conversation admires the intricacy of the problem when what's needed is a sword to to chop the knot to pieces. And I don't say that vainly. I realize it's a thing you've got to engage with and to speak to. And I delight in philosophical conversation. I could spend hours talking philosophically, but at the end of the day, the answer does have to be, well, this is what I know, and this is what has helped me. And that's kind of my take on it. So I don't know, and maybe that drives people away, or... But that's what I meant.
You know, another thing that I learn as a pastor, you spend a lot of time just waiting on things that you can't make happen.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and our beliefs, our assumptions, you know, so often, you know, I'll talk to people and they'll get to the point of saying, I want to believe in God, but I don't, and I can't. And that's true. Yeah. And Christianity has always said faith is a gift. Yeah. And so I on one hand, it's interesting to me to look at the, you know, to look at the meaning crisis. And it's interesting to ask, okay, what is this long road of philosophy and success really delivered to the West? And it's very interesting. I think Peterson, I mean, the meaning crisis seems to be predominantly a male thing, at least in the West. Not, you know, never 100%, but women, and you know, once you have a child, that child is going to be a sword cutting through that Gordian knot for a lot of women, because, yeah. And you know, and including my conversation with Voth that I just had a couple of days ago, one of my first conversations after I started making videos was with someone local who, you know, saw my video, wanted to talk to me, and told me almost exactly the same thing that Voth said. He said, you know, he had been a Christian. He had, in fact, been interested in going to seminary. But then he just sort of looked at the world, didn't believe it, gave it up, you know, got a job, got married. And then suddenly, and then had a daughter. Yeah. And he looked at that daughter and said, I can't just look at her and think she's just, you know, she's just a highly evolved mammal. or there's no, there's, she's of no more significance to the world than, you know, any other clump of matter. But my, the stuff I find myself believing in does not afford, you know, is creating dissonance in that, because I want to say I'm an atheist and this is the way the world is. But then I look at my daughter and it's like, I can't say that. What do I do? And, you know, this is a guy who had spent a long time in church. And so I, like many of these things, we have to see with new eyes. And how does that happen? You know, I'm often struck by the fact that, and I've said this in a number of my videos, if there's ever been a capable preacher, it should have been Jesus. Because, well, you know, he's the Son of God. Truth be told, his sermons continue to be read far more than anybody else's sermons in all of history. But the canonical account of his ministry is that he wanders around the Galilee. You know, huge crowds start following him, but he himself is fully aware of the fact that a lot of them are just following because they want to see a magic show and they want to get something to eat. Yeah. And then he calls them out on it. And they all walk away, except for these disciples who themselves don't really get him. And he comes to Jerusalem and he's hailed by the crowds as a, you know, ah, Son of David. That's Sunday. And by Thursday, another crowd, probably elements of the city, probably some people were in both, are yelling, crucify him. And they kill him because they want to shut him up. Mm-hmm. Well, if that's a lesson about anything, it's a lesson about human beings. And if you can buy the fact that Jesus is the Son of God and the revelation of God, and for the most part, this is the performance of his preaching. And even his disciples, you know, crucifixion, catastrophe, resurrection, what on earth is this? End of the Gospel of Matthew, some are worshiping him. That's a very un-Jewish thing. And the Gospel of Matthew, fully honest, and some doubted. Yeah, I can understand that too. Beginning of the book of Acts, now will you restore the kingdom to Israel? And it's like, this whole thing is just this dramatic mystery. And we as pastors spend years waiting around, praying, hoping, thinking, doubting, trying, failing, sometimes making more of a mess of things than if we just kept our mouth shut. And so I'm not surprised by a meaning crisis. I have one sometimes too. So, and I think you're right. It's just that I so often don't have that sword that cuts the knot.
Yeah.
And then you have to ask, well, if anybody had it, it was Jesus. And then look at how that went. And then, you know, I also often, I talk about this too, I look at the Apostle Paul and his, you know, divine intervention, his revelatory moment seems about as dramatic and as gaudy and not cutting as any, yet Jesus seems to wait until he's well into persecuting Christians and on the road to Damascus. And you would have thought when he's over by Stephen holding the coats and the heavens parted that Jesus could have said, yeah, Stephen, and you, Paul, too. Look up here. Paul doesn't see it then. So, you know, there's just a lot of waiting around in this business. And I think people got to cut their own Gordian knots.
Well, or rather someone has to do it.
Yeah. But I don't think either of us know how.
Nope, that someone is not human, that's for sure. Yeah, no, I get that. And I hope that isn't taken as a critique personally. I guess that, you know, what I really meant by that was that there is not much conversation, and I'm actually appalled, frankly, at how few you are that are communicating into this community. So you've got You know, you've got Sam Harris trying to give his answers, and you've got Peterson trying to give his answers. And I have mad respect for Peterson. I have mad respect for the effort that he has put forward and the fact that he didn't seek this out. This came to him.
Yeah.
And then he said, okay, well, here's what I'm going to do. And he tried to bring something forward that could help people. And I respect that. I also, you know, I look at it and see, that's good. It's also limited, and it fails to go all the way that it needs to go. And it's good for now, but of what eternal worth is this, you know, of what true life-changing worth is this? Because it totally depends upon you to do it. And that's a problem, because as you state, like, I know me, and talk about Auschwitz camp supervisors, I know me. Yeah. And so that's, I can recognize that. I also know that I can't do that without something bigger than me. And unfortunately, you know, although Dr. Peterson is to a degree pointing towards something, you know, I'm actually saddened how few men and women, frankly, from the Christian camps are saying, well, I know what that is. Would you care to talk about that? And let's work this out together. You're doing it, and I respect that. You know, I know Ravi's doing his best to communicate in this field, and he's much more brilliant than I will ever be. But there aren't a lot, you know, there aren't a lot who are reaching in here and saying, well, it's great that you've understood your nature. Now let's talk about how you can do something about that nature.
Yeah.
And I know what you're saying is absolutely true. I can't convince anybody. And the people I've had those same conversations you've had, where it's like, I want to believe. I actually intellectually believe, but how do I believe? I believe there's a God, and I believe that Jesus is his son, but I know that I haven't surrendered to him. And that's I can't tell you how to do that. That's got to be you reaching out to God and seeking his wisdom to do that. And I know that. You're never going to argue anyone in, but I just, you know, I want to see the offer extended.
And I, you know, one of the things that, you know, Peterson has this idea of, you know, you want to be asked to, you know, continue to play the game. And I think that's part of it. Mm. You know, as, you know, as a pastor, you know, you also know how, I already said it, you know, we wait around and we wait for God to do his thing. And, you know, I also know that sometimes it doesn't happen and you think, or someone who should know better, you know, no, they should know better. And we'll see, you know, I was frustrated, you know, the Peterson moment, really the first Peterson wave, the first big Peterson wave was October 2016 to spring 2019, you know, when, you know, his, you know, with the illness of his wife and all of this. And of course he's been sort of out of action since then. My frustration was that more, to me, I could see the opportunity as a pastor to make myself available to talk to people who wanted to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's been fruitful work. And I'm deeply humbled and grateful to have had the opportunity to do it. And I was frustrated that more pastors didn't see the opportunity and jump in. But well, that's the way these things go. And, you know, I can't answer for others. I have to answer for myself. If I see an opportunity, I have to decide what to do. And then, you know, what I say, and usually I don't say it quite right. So,
and, well, I appreciate that. I only started pastoring 6 months ago, so give me some.
Oh, you've only started 6 months ago? Oh, that's, gosh.
I just retired, yeah, in the past summer.
Oh, wow. Yeah, well, I'll tell you, nothing teaches you ministry like ministry.
That's right. I have actually been an elder at the church for like 8 years, so I've been...
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I've been in ministry, but it's full-time and fully committed. I'd like
It's different when you're not a volunteer.
Yep.
Because there's a reason they pay you.
Yeah.
They pay you, you know, it's the golden, they're not that golden, but they're handcuffs. It's like, all right, you're going to stay here and you're going to do this. And volunteers can just say, oh, I'm not feeling it. No, you're feeling it. It doesn't matter. You feel it or don't feel it. So anyway, well, this is Neil. Thank you so much for, is this something that you would like me to share with others?
If you think it's worth it, I'd certainly love to get it from you. And I would be more than happy if you put it up. And actually my intention is to enter this conversation. So my intention would be, actually, I've kind of drafted and outlined an introductory dialogue that I'll have up by Friday night at the latest. And if I can figure out how all this technology works and see if there's an appetite for that conversation. So,
okay. Well, do you have your YouTube channel up already? Is there a link that I could then include? Did you send it to me already or not?
I didn't, no.
Okay. Send it to me and I'll include it here. And that way, I mean, and follow, I'll probably post, I don't have a video to post yet tomorrow morning. So I'll probably post this tomorrow morning. And then just follow the comment section because people will engage you in the comment section. And it's my comments and my YouTube are pretty civil, but you're a big fella. You're not afraid of a little rough and tumble. That's obvious.
Yeah. That was my point in the comment you said about the roughness of Uber Boy, and I said, well, yeah, my greater fear would be that my own instinctual roughness might come out.
in my experience, it's not going to be everybody's cup of tea, but in my experience, quite frankly, people are often willing to hear somebody's unvarnished opinion. And, you know, if they're going to take offense, they're going to take offense.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, let them know what you think. But then also later, if you have a change of heart and you're wrong, nothing gets people's attention like, you know what, I was wrong. And that, you know, I talked about my father. I think about my father entering ministry in Patterson, and I mean, he couldn't have known anything about how to relate to these people. But what he was honest and genuine and loving. And you know what? There's no substitute for that. And that's far more important than all of the experience and skills. And, you know, you'll make mistakes, but you learn in the process. I mean, again, just like, I would imagine just like being a soldier in that you do basic training and you have all this training, but once you're someplace doing something, there's no preparing you. And both Haiti and then Afghanistan, how can they prepare you for that? How can they prepare you to have, you know, the guy who told you this and you follow, you know, you were going to do the right thing and the guy shows up dead. How do you prepare for that? So,
yeah,
the real deal. Well, I will post this tomorrow morning, and just keep an eye on the comment section, and all folks will have stuff to say.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And some will want to get in contact with you, and we'll have to see what Steph has to say.
Yeah. I would love to do that sometime if he's game to do that. I'm actually talking to him tomorrow. So.
Oh, good. Yeah, I think watching you two do a video together, that would be fun. Those two guys, you know, I don't have time to watch all their videos. I wouldn't have time to watch all my videos. But those two guys are sharp, and they are witty and clever. And you know, Jung is hard, and you know, I can't judge how right or wrong they get Jung, but they sure are fun to listen to.
I actually do have one video that I can send you a link to. It's unlisted, but it's me and Steph chatting and just kind of establishing our left and right of arcs for future engagement. So,
oh, fun!
About a half an hour, and
okay,
it's really neat to me to listen to that guy because of how tremendously insightful he can be.
Yeah. Yeah,
and some of the the ways that he communicates ideas, which are amusingly, I think, original to him, although other people have used similar analogies. But he's really perceptive of what Christianity ought to be.
Yeah,
and that's interesting. So I'll when I send you the link to my YouTube channel, I'll fire you that link, and if you. Yeah, Nav, I think it's 25 minutes long after we hashed a bunch of stuff out. You might find that entertaining.
Okay, I'm sure I will. Well, thank you, Neil.
God bless, Paul.
God bless you. Yep, bye-bye.